Sanctions on Russia are having some effect, but will they bring down Putin?
Sadly, I don't think that that's likely, but that's because Vladimir Putin doesn't care about the economic well-being of his country.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also today, Ukraine's president thanked his country's first responders for keeping things as normal as possible.
Ми робимо те, дуже небезпечно для життя.
We do have this sense of fear at the back of our minds, but we're trying not to think about it and we're trying to do the job.
And Marco Werman in the West Bank talks water shortages with residents.
It means we have to cut back on everything, she says, showering, cooking, cleaning the house.
Also, a new journalism school in the UK aims to get more young people of color into the profession. That's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for being with us today. Western allies have used sanctions in an attempt to weaken Russia and hinder its ability to fight Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin and more than 1,700 others have been targeted. Today, the European Union's top court said two of those men, Mikhail Fridman and Pyotr Avin, didn't deserve to be on the sanctions list early in the war. The ruling raises a bigger question, though. Do sanctions on Russia actually do anything? Maximilian Hess is with the Foreign Policy Research Institute in London.
There's about $300 billion in the Kremlin's money out there that's frozen. The majority of it, around two-thirds, $200 billion, is at one institution in Belgium called Euroclear. In terms of the amount of actual dollar assets from sanctioned individuals, it is certainly technically even larger, although there's no sort of one exact estimate, but a number of Russian multi-billionaires have been affected by these sanctions.
So what exactly has been happening with these assets? Who is in charge of managing them? And what happens when an asset is frozen?
This case today is a rather interesting example because the two individuals owned a very large Western company and invested across retail to oil and gas networks in Germany, to telecommunications companies across Europe and including even in Ukraine. Those are being managed here in the UK. You have a few other similar cases, but that one's relatively idiosyncratic because so much of their assets were in the West. For the frozen Russian state money, it's really Euroclear whose management is overseeing that, given the lion's share of its funds there. Other funds that are frozen mostly in the UK, a little bit in Switzerland as well, and some in the United States, tend to be managed by the banks who were custodians of those assets prior to the designations.
So then does the money just flow somewhere else and not to the Russian owners of these companies?
The money essentially stays with the banks and the custodians of it at the time. What
Got
happens
it.
To that money in the future is a very important question, particularly with regards to the Russian central bank's assets. And there we've already seen the European government's move to tax those assets for the benefit of Ukraine. That's expected to raise around 3 billion euros this year. And now there's a very large debate around whether the other amounts of those Russian government frozen assets can be used to benefit Ukraine.
What is the argument against directing either the interest or more of those assets themselves to Ukraine?
The argument against it is primarily that it would set a dangerous precedent about foreign governments' assets no longer being secure in Western markets and that they will therefore move their money out of the West. Mm. Certainly, Russia was already doing that, but we have seen no acceleration in that trend since the sanctioning and freezing of these assets. But that is the concern, and some European governments have been more vocal about that, whereas the U.S. and the U.K., the Biden administration in particular, have come out very forcefully or more forcefully in favor of this idea in recent months.
Russia's war in Ukraine has obviously been going on for more than 2 years. Has the freezing of Russian government assets had any impact on Putin's ability to wage this war?
It certainly has had an impact on his ability to wage the war. But no, the sort of idea that sanctions could collapse Russia and stop the war in its tracks, I don't think that was ever realistic. But certainly they perform a key role as a very important impediment and mitigating factor and cost for the Kremlin in continuing to execute this war. But whether they can get to a point that finally tips that balance over and causing Putin to readjust his decision-making process, sadly, I don't think that that's likely, but that's because Vladimir Putin doesn't care about the economic well-being of his country. He's far more focused on his military agenda.
Maximilian Hess is a fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. In his latest video address to the nation, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky stood on a street in Ukraine's second largest city, Kharkiv, that has been under bombardment. He thanked the first responders who helped keep the country running, emergency service rescuers, power grid engineers, and repair crews. Because as the world's Daniel Offman reports, they jump into action when Russian air attacks hit their targets.
This is what it sounds like to be near an explosive drone attack. Videos like this often appear on social media soon after Russian strikes. The man in the video yells, "Lie down," moments before the drone hits its target. You can see the explosion in the distance. This attack took place last Thursday in the northeastern Ukrainian city of Kharkiv. But attacks like this happen all over the country. Firefighters and rescuers have less than 3 minutes to get ready before climbing into their fire trucks and rushing to the scene. On this day, at the Holosivsky District Fire Station in southern Kyiv, firefighters and rescuers are running a drill to test their preparedness. They sprint from inside the station to the fire truck, geared up and ready to depart. Later, they check their equipment. They test saws, cutters, and other high-power rescue tools. This equipment is used in situations where metal or other material needs to be cut or dislodged to save someone. The man running the drill is in his early 30s. He wears a black, red, and neon yellow firefighter uniform.
My name is Vyacheslav Tarashenko. I'm a firefighter and a rescue from Kyiv.
Tarashenko says he wanted to become a rescuer since he was in high school in his hometown of Mykolaiv in southern Ukraine. When he graduated in 2012, he enrolled in the Firefighter Academy in Kharkiv. Tarashenko has a clever smile on his face when he tells the story of his first field assignment at the academy.
Я був першим і єдиним. Я так думаю, що за історію цієї навчально-пожежної частини я отримав двійку.
I think I was the first and the only student in the history of that academy that would get a D for that assignment, because when we were putting out the fire, I joined the real experienced firefighter and I went inside the burning house, which I wasn't supposed to do. And when my commanding officer saw me, he screamed at me, told me to get out of the house and said, "You get a D because you were not supposed to go there."
But despite the rocky start, Tarashenko graduated and got his first job in 2016. Tarashenko says the job changed drastically after Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022.
Змінилося через те, що постійно в напрузі.
My life has changed a lot because you're under constant stress and you're mostly stressed not about your own well-being, but about the health and safety of your family.
Tarashenko says that his mother still lives in his hometown of Mykolaiv, a city a lot closer to the front lines than Kyiv and therefore more dangerous. He says that he's tried to convince her to move, but she won't budge, even after relatives were killed in an attack nearby.
Після того, як прилетіла касета в будинок родичів,
we had a cluster munition hit the house where my cousins lived, and two of them died.
That's why Tarashenko says he's more concerned about his mother's safety than his own. He says being a first responder in Ukraine is highly dangerous, in part because of a Russian tactic called double tapping, which is a second attack targeting rescuers.
Були так само, як і повторні обстріли по тих самих місцях.
Whenever there was a shelling or a missile hit and rescue workers would go there, very often there were repeated hits in the same spot. And that, of course, made our work much more difficult.
Working under that kind of stress takes a toll on you, Tarashenko says. Just last week, Ukraine's interior minister posted a video from the aftermath of an attack in Kharkiv. In the video, a young firefighter breaks down in tears after he finds out that his father, also a rescue worker, was killed in a double-tap strike. Other rescue workers hug him. They tell him to breathe, trying to calm and console him. Tarashenko says that in order to be a first responder, you need to stay focused and remain mentally strong.
Мозок постійно знаходиться в напрузі.
Your brain is under constant stress because you need to calm people down who are asking for help. You need to assess the risks and the threats to find the best way to help these people.
Tarashenko says that when he's off the job, he does three things to maintain his mental health. He speaks with a therapist, he goes for long walks at night, and he listens to classical music, mostly Beethoven and Bach.
Ми робимо те, що дуже небезпечно для життя.
We also understand and accept the fact that, war or not, we are working in a dangerous business. So we do have this sense of fear at the back of our minds, but we're trying not to think about it and we're trying to do the job to the best of our abilities.
Tarashenko says that a thought that helps him with the job is that he feels that he's needed. Despite not being a soldier fighting on the front lines, he says that he sees how much he could help other people as a first responder. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
This week, Marco Werman and a team from our newsroom are reporting from Israel about the war with Hamas. The destruction caused by that war is especially poignant today as Muslims mark the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Marco is in Jerusalem, where Palestinians are beginning 3 days of observations for Eid al-Fitr.
Thanks, Carolyn. Eid is generally a festive celebration, but today, this year, it's very low-key for most Muslims here in Israel and the Palestinian territories. Mohammed Darawshi is in Nazareth, about 90 miles north of Jerusalem. Here's what he told me about how he's feeling today.
Actually, it's not celebration. This holiday usually symbolizes a lot of joy. Unfortunately, this year it's filled with a lot of agony and a lot of sorrow for what we've been witnessing over the last 6 months. When the month of Ramadan was supposed to be the symbol of generosity, and the symbol of eating together as families, and all of this was lost in Gaza. This transcends into the Palestinian community also in Israel and around the world. It's very difficult to feel joy. It's very difficult to feel happy. Still, we have to commit to our religious and cultural duties. In a household like mine, I need to visit something like 20, 30 people during the 3 days of the holiday. No one is serving sweets. No one is doing barbecue. Everything is very, very simple, very humble.
Can you share just a couple of moments of what that's been like as you've made the rounds today?
You don't see kids in the streets playing. No music. Kids usually are in cars, and the younger kids in cars with loud music going around the streets in the town. Most people didn't buy new clothing or new furniture. This is also the time that if you need new furniture, this is the time to buy it, because that's when you host people. And people are simply ashamed of trying to look new, to look well-dressed, or to look even with full stomach.
I know the standard greeting on Eid is Eid Mubarak. Are you even able to express that?
Well, Eid Mubarak is a blessed Eid, and it's definitely not blessed. Most people replace the greeting instead of saying "Kul am wa antum bikhir," meaning we hope every year and you will be in good. It's basically the greeting has changed, and it includes Gaza as a prayer that next year or next Eid it will be in good shape, and definitely not in the shape. The sense of mourning is hovering over our communities.
Mohammed Darawshi in Nazareth with his thoughts on Eid this year from Muslims in this part of the world.
Marco will be back later with more perspectives after 6 months of Israel's war in Gaza. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. If you've taken passenger flights, you've likely flown aboard a plane made by Boeing. The company supplies aircraft for many of the world's top airlines, and it's had a string of bad reports about the safety of its planes. There were deadly accidents 5 years ago involving the 737 MAX 8 planes in Ethiopia and Indonesia, and more recently that door plug incident on an Alaskan Airlines 737 MAX 9. Now, the Federal Aviation Administration is investigating new concerns concerns about Boeing's 787 Dreamliner. Claire Bushey follows the aircraft industry for Britain's Financial Times. Claire, a whistleblower complaint about Boeing's 787 Dreamliner is in the news today. What is the FAA concerned about?
So an engineer at Boeing has told them that the sections of the body of the plane known as the fuselage are not held together very well, that it could degrade over time and causing the plane to break apart. Boeing says that is wrong and it is inaccurate.
So Boeing says this is not happening, but if it were, that sounds pretty serious. Would it be dangerous for passengers?
It would be life-threatening. It would be a crash if it happened in the air.
Hmm. This is, of course, just the latest in a string of safety concerns for Boeing. What is the company doing to improve manufacturing quality?
Well, most recently, at the end of March, they announced that their chief executive, Dave Calhoun, would be leaving at the end of the year. The chairman of the board is going to be leaving after their annual meeting. And the head of their commercial airplanes division left last month. And there's the hope that that will be enough for their airline customers and that they will no longer be nervous.
So there are two main huge players in the aircraft business. One is Boeing and the other is Europe's Airbus. How have Boeing's continuing problems affected its competitive edge with Airbus?
It has been disastrous for Boeing. Airbus and Boeing have been duking it out for 50 years. They have a duopoly in commercial aviation. And when Boeing's 737s were grounded for nearly 2 years following two crashes that killed, you know, a combined 346 people, Airbus surged ahead in selling single aisle planes. And of course, there was COVID in there too. You can't forget that devastated the market for commercial aviation. But Boeing was already behind at that point. And so Airbus is now outselling Boeing basically by 2-1 in the single aisle market, which is the really critical market for plane makers.
Is Boeing too big to fail?
Yes, it's very much in the interest of the air carriers around the world to have two competing plane makers, because then they have to compete against each other on price in order to win orders. And they also have to compete against each other to develop newer, better technology, because that, again, helps you win orders. So the world's air carriers don't want Boeing to fade. And it's also an incredibly important contractor for the U.S. government for all sorts of weaponry. So the U.S. government also has a very active interest in Boeing continuing to do well.
Claire Bushey covers the aviation industry for Britain's Financial Times. She was updating us on new safety concerns about aircraft made by Boeing. Now, artists often search for beauty in tragedy. Musician Valeria Castro is no exception. She grew up in the shadow of an active volcano on the island of La Palma. That's in the Canary Islands, just off the coast of Morocco. The volcano started erupting in September 2021, and it went on for 85 days. No one was killed, but 1,000 homes were destroyed. The world's April Peavy has more.
The volcano on La Palma erupted 2.5 years ago on September 19th. Hot red lava moved its way to the coastal villages below. La Palma was in a state of emergency. The destruction affected thousands, including the family of Valeria Castro.
Everything touched me so much, you know, because all the memories from my grandma was there.
Her grandmother's house was destroyed, as well as many other places Castro remembered as a kid growing up in La Palma. To help her process the loss, Castro turned to music. The first song she wrote was this one, La Raíz, or The Root in English. Todo se inunda y piensas que nunca toca la bala en tu pecho y asusta y todo parece que en unos meses sigues pensando que igual es tu culpa y tú
mirando a todos lados. That song is so special because it helped me to move on in this awful thing that happened to so many people in my island and also my family.
The song appears on Castro's debut album, Con Cariño y Con Cuidado. It's an album that emerged from the ashes and connected Castro to her roots.
My family always tried to teach me, you know, to live with tender and with care for everything in my life.
Music was everything to Castro as a child. She started playing piano at age 4. By the time she was 17, she posted videos doing cover songs on social media, and you can probably guess what happened next. One of her favorite artists shared her posting, Spanish musician and singer Alejandro Sanz.
For a kid from La Palma, being listened by Alejandro Sanz is something so big, you know, so it was so special, and I remember it, and I always remember it with so much love.
Signing to a major record label came next. She re-recorded some of those cover songs, including Desde Cuando by Alejandro Sanz. Castro was cautious about that first quick flurry of fame. She needed a backup, just in case her music career fizzled. Her backup plan meant leaving La Palma and heading for Madrid for a degree in biotechnology.
It was the plan B, you know, but I never stopped music. My mom wanted me to make a university career just in case.
Just in case. But now at 24, her plan A, a music career, seems to have worked out just fine. Castro's received a Latin Grammy nomination, performed at sold-out shows throughout Spain, and has collaborated with some of her favorite artists. Valerio Castro is fully prepared for whatever happens next. For The World, I'm April Peavy.
Water in the West Bank, coming up in the second half of the show. You're listening to The World. Farmers in India are not happy. They're staging demonstrations to demand guaranteed crop prices. Farmers' anger could affect elections beginning next month. Also, the popular board game Catan faces an energy crisis. That and more ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Israel says more aid trucks entered the Gaza Strip on Tuesday than at any time since the start of the war. Officials say 468 aid trucks were inspected and transferred into Gaza, and there were airdrops of supplies as well. The World's Marco Werman is in Jerusalem this week reporting on the conflict. He explains that 6 months on from the deadly attacks of October 7th, access to resources continues to be a big problem for Palestinians.
Hello again from Jerusalem, Carolyn. As the war continues in Gaza, Palestinians in the West Bank, already under pressure from Israeli security, are experiencing heightened tension in the Israeli-occupied territories in a wide variety of ways, including the flow of water. I went to a Palestinian farming area on the outskirts of Ramallah in the West Bank to see what's happening there. The moment you cross into the West Bank from Israel, you start to see them. Dotted across rooftops, on single homes, apartment buildings, commercial real estate, giant plastic storage tanks. They're filled with water because availability here is unreliable. Black tanks for hot water, white for cool. This is the home of Yusuf Shrete on the outskirts of Ramallah. He's Palestinian, a farmer who relies on water for cultivation and for his family's daily needs at home. On the day I was there, he showed me water was running, but he quickly shut off the spigot to not waste it. Pressure from the pipes continued to send more water up to the tanks on his roof. I asked Shrette about the need for those black water tanks. Unfortunately, he said, those black tanks mean our lives in this country are dark. For generations, our families have suffered under Israeli occupation. He described their 120-acre plot of farmland. There's a spring there that our village relied on for years, he explained. 50 to 60 family members used to grow vegetables, olives, citrus, all sorts of fruits. Then 30 years ago, we got connected to the main water system. But he says it's erratic. Sometimes the pipeline is only open one day every 2 weeks. And in the summer, every month or two, we experience pain. For Shrette's daughter, Izdahar, the shortages impact all aspects of their lives. It means we have to cut back on everything, she says. Showering, cooking, cleaning the house. That irregularity falls on the Palestinian Authority, which purchases water from Mekorot, the Israel National Water Company. But according to Amnesty International, it's Israel that determines how much it will sell to Palestinian water utilities. Not long after October 7th last year, Shrette says he went to water his farm and was threatened at gunpoint by Israelis living in a nearby settlement who told him not to come back. They blocked the road with rocks and dirt and put up a gate, he explains. And for the past 6 months, I have not returned to my farm. My life is there. It's my existence, he said. I don't know why they did this. Sources in the Israeli Civil Administration, Israel's governing body that operates in the West Bank, speaking off the record, told me that Palestinians are exaggerating such claims. They also said that Israel supplies water to the Palestinian Authority, but after that, it's their responsibility to deliver it fairly. In downtown Ramallah, I met Abdelrahman Al-Tamimi, the director of the Palestinian Hydrology Group for Water and Environmental Resources Development. He says he's well aware of the pressure that has been brought by Israeli authorities on Palestinians in the West Bank since October 7th. Specifically when it comes to water, he thinks that for a long time, some of the blame goes to the Palestinian Authority for not attending to the needs of its people.
First of all, we need real estate, democratic state, transparent state. And in my opinion, the Palestinian Authority failed to play this role. That's why the election is the only solution to have a good government, good authority, and transparent governor.
As for Israel, Tamimi told me, its internationally recognized borders, the Green Line, should not dictate the environmental reality.
Water can be a conflict factor, but also can be a cooperation factor if there is a good willing, because the God doesn't recognize so-called the Green Line. The water comes from the sky to the Palestinian mountains underground, flow to the Israeli mountain. The water comes from Israel to Gaza. That's why the area from Dead Sea to the Mediterranean, it's one hydrologic basin. Unfortunately, the Israelis, they want to see that whole area under their control.
And right now, says Tamimi, the hopes that water can be a factor in cooperation between Israelis and Palestinians is slim.
No Palestinian farmer will accept seeing his fruits and his plants drying up while the settlers, they have swimming pools. This is racism, totally racism.
Abdelrahman Al-Tamimi's point of view there on racism will get no pushback from Palestinian-Israeli politician Sami Abu Shehadeh. He's a former member of Israel's Knesset and chairman of Balad, a political party representing Arab Israelis. The Balad party was voted out in 2022, which means currently only 5 Palestinian-Israeli lawmakers are in the parliament out of 120 total members. I met with Sami Abu Shehadeh in his office in Jaffa, a mixed Arab and Israeli city just south of Tel Aviv.
The Palestinians are spread all over historical Palestine, which means including the state of Israel. And I am representing this Palestinian minority. We are 20% of the population. We are Israeli citizens. When we are talking about the war, people should have in mind that those people who are passing this unbelievable crimes in Gaza by the Israeli military are our families. And it puts us in a very complicated situation of suffering daily. And another very important thing, I want everybody to know that we are against the war. We are against violence. We don't believe that there's a militaristic violent solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And we believe that there must be a historical compromise between the two people.
That's totally understandable from the historic perspective. I'm just wondering, in terms of October 7th, given what you see around you, was the military response surprising?
First of all, I am totally against starting history from the 7th of October, as if there has been no history before and no present after, without historical context. When you read it out of context, you will never be able to understand what happened.
How should this end? I mean, what should happen next? I mean, in terms of the war and getting to the next step?
In the very close future, what should happen is, first of all, to end the war, to do this deal of exchanging the prisoners. And
when you say deal exchanging the prisoners, Palestinian prisoners in exchange for hostages, explain that.
I deal with both sides as hostages, prisoners, call it, and use the word that you want, okay? Because thousands of Palestinian hostages, thousands, without trial, are being held illegally by the Israelis. Before the 7th of October and after the 7th of October, the numbers have raised.
That's the kind of exchange you're talking about.
I'm talking about bringing all of the hostages and the prisoners, all of them, okay? From both sides. And both leaderships must open a horizon for a better future for both sides. This situation cannot continue. Any solution built on Jewish superiority cannot continue. Both sides should acknowledge the other, the rights of the other, collective and individual rights, respect the other, and build a normal democratic regime for both sides. Now, people would ask me, in one-state solution, two-state? I don't care. If they want to have it in two-state solution, one-state solution, binational, confederation, federation, this is not the issue. The issue is that you deal with human beings, all of them as equal human beings. You have a political frame which is built on justice and equality for all, giving a better future for the children of both sides. This is what counts.
Do you see energy around that kind of movement starting to appear anywhere?
Unfortunately, in this very, very, very dark situation, I'm seeing that mainly in the Israeli society where I live, that the mentality of anger and revenge is making the vast majority in the Israeli society blind to the suffering of the Palestinians.
And so with this trend with the current government to move even more far to the right, and you have an event like October 7th seeming to give that legitimacy, how do you change that?
The only source of hope in this complicated situation I see is international pressure being put on the Israeli government to lead to a political solution.
I wanted to ask you about the United States. The last couple of months have seen a slow buildup of pressure from the White House. And I'm just wondering, what do you think of President Biden's approach to Israel's war on Hamas?
Without the American diplomatic, political, military support, and economic support for Israel since the 7th of October, this war would have ended long, long time ago. And we wouldn't have seen this brutal crimes against children, women, and all of the people in Gaza. Lately, we are seeing a positive change. And we know that it's not an easy change in the American administration. And this is something good and brave to do. But it is not enough.
What more needs to happen?
The same administration can tell Israel to stop the war now and to lead for a political solution for both sides, Jews and Palestinians. Without that, they should know that the Israeli society has deteriorated to this crazy situation. The next step, what we are hearing from Israeli politicians, is another war on Lebanon and another war on Syria and the opening a crazy war with the Iranians. Why do we need all these wars? We want this to be the last war. We don't have to want any more wars. We want to live like any other normal human beings in the world. We want the war to be an exception in our lives.
That was Palestinian-Israeli politician Sami Abu Shahadeh speaking with Marco Werman. There are a lot of farmers in India. Two-thirds of the country's population works in agriculture, but many of them are poor, and they want the government to do more to help them. That's led to a lot of tension over the past few years. Sushmita Pathak reports on how the situation for Indian farmers might affect the country's upcoming election.
It's a hot afternoon in Delhi. No clouds in the sky, no relief. But unfazed by the blazing heat, hundreds of farmers have gathered in a huge open ground in the heart of India's capital. They're sitting in small groups, listening to union leaders make passionate speeches from a small stage. Some burst into slogans now and then. The anger is laser-focused on one man, Narendra Modi, India's Prime Minister. Modi betrayed us, says farmer Satinder Singh, who's come from the northern state of Punjab. In 2020 and 2021, farmers protested in Delhi for more than a year over new laws that they felt would benefit large companies. Modi conceded and took them back. But we had another demand that Modi has ignored, says Karamjeet Kaur, also from Punjab. That demand is about MSP, minimum support price. It's a guaranteed price set by the government to protect farmers against market volatility. Minimum support price acts as a safety net, explains economist Seema Batla. But there's a catch.
MSP is for 23 crops, but it is effective only for a few like sugarcane, wheat, paddy, cotton, jute because of procurement.
As in government procurement, when the government buys the commodities for public distribution. It mainly buys wheat and rice. Other crops often get sold at rates lower than the minimum support price. To prevent that from happening, farmers want MSP to be written into law so that it is enforced. They also want higher MSPs. Farming is no longer profitable. We're barely able to make ends meet, says Hari Singh Burdak, a farmer from Rajasthan. Farmer incomes have not been rising, while the cost of fertilizer, pesticides, seeds has surged, says Batla, the economist. But legalizing minimum support price is not a solution, she says.
Legalization is not possible. There will not be private trade in that case in the market. If you say, okay, fine, if you do not buy at this particular price which the government announces, then you will be behind the bars. Then only government will be buying it.
That could end up costing the government a lot. It's not feasible, some experts say. The loudest demand for legalization of minimum support price is coming from Punjab, the breadbasket of India. Farmers there mainly grow wheat and rice and benefit the most from minimum support prices. But in other parts of India, farmers' struggles have little to do with MSP. In rural Jharkhand, some 800 miles southeast of Delhi, most farmers haven't heard of the recent protests in the capital. Nibha Devi is a farmer and a community worker who teaches best practices to other farmers. Farmers here have very little land, she says. The state doesn't have good irrigation systems, and agriculture is mostly rain-fed, so farmers are only able to grow crops in certain seasons. There's another big problem. Climate change. It is pouring as I drive to meet Nibha Devi and other farmers, which is not expected this time of the year. Unpredictable climate has become the biggest problem, she says. One spell of rain or hailstorm can destroy the harvest. Farmers incur huge losses, and sometimes they just lose hope, she says. To boost incomes, the government of Jharkhand state has been helping farmers set up micro-drip irrigation systems. It's also encouraging farmers to grow horticulture crops, which can be more lucrative. Baburam Mato got his roadside farm fitted with drip irrigation in January and is growing watermelon. I will now farm all year round, he says. I ask him if he wants his son to become a farmer. I hope he does something else. You can't make much from this small farm, he says. Nibha Devi, the community worker, says farmers' kids see their parents toil their whole lives but get little in return, which discourages them. Farming is back-breaking work. It's not easy. But without farmers, no one can survive, she says. At the ground in Delhi, a group of men sing an uplifting song, urging farmers to keep up the fight, even though it is long. The general election starts on April 19th, and farmers at the rally are determined to bring down Modi. We will teach Modi a lesson, says Hari Singh Burdak, the farmer from Rajasthan. We made this government. We can destroy it too, he says. Farmers are an important voting bloc in India, but they are not a monolith. And political commentators say their dissatisfaction may not be enough to dent Modi's electoral prospects. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak, Delhi.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Lack of diversity in the media is an ongoing problem. In Britain, for example, 0.2% of journalists are Black, according to the educational charity Sutton Trust. Around 80% of news editors were educated in private schools. A new journalism school for children and teenagers in London hopes to address some of the imbalance. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has more.
My name's Kemi.
My name's Aurea. And my name is Ariana.
These are three of the students who started their first week at journalism school on Monday. And they're young.
I'm 13.
I'm 11.
I'm like 10.
Although they're not even the youngest in class that day.
My name's Sullivan and I'm 6.
Alongside 6-year-old Sullivan, 13-year-old Kemi tells me she likes writing stories, but she's not really sure journalism is for her.
For me personally, I want to be an engineer, but I do enjoy the creative writing skill as a whole.
The Coco School of Journalism is the first of its kind in Britain. It's the brainchild of Sir Lena Boyd.
I want to allow children to have this world of becoming a journalist so that they can publish and write their own stories, because there's a lot of things that sometimes are written about our culture that sometimes are not necessarily true.
Boyd says the UK really needs more diverse voices reporting the news, and she's some experience finding those voices. In 2020, she founded Coco Girl, the first major Black children's magazine in Britain. The idea came to her after her 6-year-old daughter Faith arrived home from school one day, upset.
And saying, "Mummy, I don't want to be the colour I am anymore."
Faith was one of the few Black children in her school. Boyd thought a magazine written by and for Black children might be a way to boost Faith's self-confidence. And the publication took off. Today it's distributed to 500 schools across the UK, and members of the magazine's young team are often invited to interview high-profile actors.
Hi, I'm Zeno, a journalist for Coco Girl magazine that represents beautiful girls just like me. Congratulations on your fantastic movie.
Young Janae Bartlett got to interview actress Halle Bailey, who plays Ariel in The Little Mermaid movie. Bartlett asked the actress if she's any advice for young Black girls like herself.
Go after what you want in life. Don't let anybody stop you or tear you down or make you feel like you can't, because you can. You always can.
But that determination may not always be enough. The Media Diversity Institute reports that 94% of journalists in Britain are white, even though almost 18% of the population belongs to a Black, Asian or other ethnic group. Some Black journalists say this affects how stories are told. In 2020, as the Black Lives Matter protests kicked off following the killing of George Floyd at the hands of police, thousands took to the streets of London to protest.
What do we want? Justice! What do we want?
But journalist Angelo Boccato says much of the British media chose to ignore what was happening right in front of them.
The main outlook was about their take on what was happening in the US, not their take on what's happening to people of African descent in the UK.
Boccato says 2 years later, when a young unarmed Black man was shot dead by a police officer in London, his killing got little coverage.
Chris Cabot, 24-year-old, was shot dead by police in Streatham Hill on the 5th of September 2022. Only 3 days later, Queen Elizabeth II died. That event, the brutal murder by the police of a 24-year-old young black man, kind of disappeared from the news cycle.
Bokatha says he wonders if the news coverage of Chris Kaba's killing would have been more prominent if there were more black editors in the newsroom then. Even for black journalists who make it into high-profile roles, it's not always easy.
I feel like being one of few black journalists in the UK landscape means that you're already under intense scrutiny, even more so than your white counterparts.
Nadine White is race correspondent with the Independent newspaper. She told the BBC that sometimes that intense scrutiny can come at a price.
Pretty much every story that I post, yeah, there's trolls, racist trolls in my mentions, being unpleasant and abusive.
Still, while the number of black journalists in Britain may be low, some say the journalism courses are still more diverse than in many European countries.
I mean, for someone who can come from Italy like myself, for me, just the moment I step into London, I was like welcomed by people from different backgrounds and ethnic minorities. So yes, my course was really diverse, I would say.
Stefania Okereke is a freelance journalist currently working for the BBC. In Italy, she says she was often the only black girl in her class. So far, Okereke says she finds the media environment in London to be pretty supportive. And opening a journalism school for black children is a good start.
That's very empowering for that next generation to see. I wish there could be something like that in Italy, when we are very behind.
Founder of the journalism school, Serlina Boyd, says she's optimistic the idea will spread, like her magazine, Coco Girl. Come September, it's set to be launched in the US. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The popular board game Catan, originally known as Settlers of Catan, has announced a new edition, challenging players to tackle climate change. Piece of cake, right? In the game, players build civilizations using natural resources. Players used to build pre-industrial societies out of bricks, wood, and ore. The game's inventor, Klaus Teuber, described in a documentary that he was inspired by history.
Yes, the story of the Vikings inspired me. I imagine how they reach Iceland. They need wood, they need houses and all the things and so on.
In an updated version of the game, modern-day islanders face an energy crisis. Each player must decide whether to invest in clean energy or stick with fossil fuels. Those are cheaper than renewables in the game, though not in much of the real world. Catan, New Energies, comes after Teuber's death last week. In that same documentary, he chronicled his unusual path to creating games.
In the 90s and 80s, I led a dental laboratory. Developing games was a little bit a refuge for me.
Teuber's son said in a statement that his dad believed a game is not a lecture and that it's not telling players how to act. We've been hearing Marco Werman's reporting from the Middle East all this week. Tomorrow on the show, Marco takes us to an arts club in Jerusalem where Jews and Palestinians come together in peace during wartime. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. I am Carolyn Beeler. Thank you so much for listening.